It is Tuesday, November 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Turkish police detain at least 35 government opponents. Chinese officials announce a new five-year plan.
You know, as we look at China and its big modern cities of Beijing and Shanghai, Guangzhou, Shenzhen, we can't forget that this is still a country that is largely run from the top down.
And pop singers Demi Lovato and Nick Jonas plan to tour together. It's all ahead. Just 2 days after a solid parliamentary election victory by the ruling Justice and Democracy Party, or AK, Turkish police Tuesday detained at least 35 people. They include regional administrators and former police chiefs in western Izmir province, believed to be supporters of a Muslim cleric opposed to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. On Monday, police raided the offices of the magazine Nokta, and its latest publication warned the election paves the way for the beginning of civil war. Two editors were detained. The arrests follow expressed Western misgivings about how the Turkish government has targeted media outlets and journalists critical of Mr. Erdogan, who has been at the pinnacle of Turkish politics for more than a decade. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Elizabeth Trudeau Monday reacted to concerns expressed by international observers of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE.
We understand the OSCE will issue a comprehensive final report on the election in coming weeks. We note the OSCE released a statement of preliminary findings today, highlighting that the elections offered voters a variety of choices, but that restrictions on media freedom remain a serious concern. We reiterate our own concerns that media outlets and individual journalists critical of the government were subject to pressure and intimidation during the campaign, seemingly in a manner calculated to weaken political opposition. We urge Turkish authorities to ensure their actions uphold the universal democratic values enshrined in Turkey's constitution.
A White House spokesman Monday said the U.S. has publicly and privately raised its concerns about freedom of the press, speech, and freedom of assembly in Turkey. President Obama is scheduled to travel to Turkey to attend the two-day G20 summit on November 15th. It's unclear whether he will meet with Mr. Erdogan. Regional analyst Jonathan Adelman, associate professor at the University of Denver, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Turkish leader is becoming increasingly autocratic, and his election victory is a disappointment.
We appreciated what Turkey had done under Tayyip Erdogan in the early years. But in the last few years, he has turned to becoming extremely authoritarian, to the bloody conflict with the Kurds, towards Islamic fundamentalism. And we had hoped that Turkey would be a real model for the Middle East about how you could be both Islamic and modern. And so this is very disturbing to many policymakers in Washington and in Europe.
International election observers Monday said the elections were free and peaceful, but criticized media restrictions in the run-up to the vote, including the seizure by the government of an opposition media company and criminal investigations of journalists who allegedly supported terrorism or defamed Mr. Erdogan.
What is so worrisome is that Turkey was doing very well economically. It almost tripled its GNP. There was major reform of the Turkish economy, and people thought that here was a real model for so many of the countries in the Middle East that have done just so terribly and haven't been able to move towards relatively free elections, towards more democratic means and kind of social capitalism. And so this is extraordinarily demoralizing because, after all, Turkey used to rule the Middle East for 400 years as the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and a lot of people were really hopeful, but he, in his older years, has just seemed to want to create a one-man dictatorship now as president before as prime minister. And, you know, this is not the first election. They had one only a couple months ago in which he did not get a majority. And we saw the kind of multi-party system that we were all really hoping to see in the Middle East, and it's so rare. So it's disappointing, but the real question, of course, is how far is he going to try to pursue these notions of a one-party dictatorship? And he's building his support heavily on the countryside and the people from the countryside who moved into the big cities such as Istanbul. And also because it's a vital part of NATO. It is the southern flank of NATO. We've had a lot of problems with them on taking in, letting ISIS people transit through Turkey to come into Syria and to Iraq. And so there's a lot of discussions that are going to have to be held in the next few months. And hopefully we can see some improvement despite this election majority.
According to the French press agency, the European Union, desperate for help to solve the migrant crisis, has little option but to deal with Mr. Erdogan on his own terms following his election victory. They said he can now set the agenda for a European Union which dislikes doing business with a man who wants to join the bloc but also flouts its rules on human rights and press freedom. One analyst say the EU will be forced to swallow its pride, pander to the hubristic ego of President Erdogan.
There's little doubt that this analysis is largely correct, and it's a very sad one because this isn't the Erdogan that we knew 5 or 7 years ago or his AK Justice and Development Party. It was trumpeted for what it had done for the economy and for poor people and so forth. But right now, the Europeans facing a deluge of immigrants. I mean, there's up to 800,000 people out there right now who are trying to migrate to Europe, and it's estimated there could be easily another million or two within the next 6 months or a year. Turkey holds the keys. He knows that. And it's a sad moment for the EU, but I think it's a sadder moment for the Middle East.
That's Jonathan Adelman, associate professor at the University of Denver. Well, joining us with what's being said in social media today is my colleague, Susan Yaki.
Hi, everyone. Concerning the Turkish election, on Twitter there is a link to the World Post where Frederick Gerndink asks, would it have been better if the AKP had not won a majority in Turkey's election Sunday? Based on the mood of those who don't support President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the AKP, you would think so. But the truth is, it wouldn't have made much difference. Against Erdogan's authoritarianism, only relentless persistence and a true alternative will one day prevail. The AKP won because Erdogan used two dirty weapons. One, violence against the Kurdish political movement, including the armed PKK, and two, authoritarianism. Democracy Now! Says Erdogan regains parliamentary majority amid violence, media crackdown, fear. YF Pushkin writes, Turkey election to provide little hope for economy.
What else is online today?
Well, Sarah, on Facebook, the New York Times writes, one of the biggest names in traditional video games is making its boldest step yet into the fast-growing world of mobile gaming with a multi-billion dollar acquisition of a one-time darling. It says Activision Blizzard said late on Monday that it planned to buy King Digital Entertainment, the home of Candy Crush Saga, for about $5.9 billion to help expand its global reach. Spencer Haven says Activision sees this as a way to cement themselves as the top company of video games. However, it is expected to take until spring 2016 for the deal to finalize, so you'll have to wait to play the upcoming Call of Duty Sugar Rush. And David Sobeski on Facebook writes, interesting acquisition. At first, I thought it did not make sense, but to really get them into mobile and be a top publisher, it is a good deal for Activision. I thought they would have purchased Supercell as it fits the type of games they publish. But King is much better for its reach and mobile knowledge. Sarah?
Thanks very much, Susan. That's International Edition's Susan Yaki. China says that during its next five-year plan, more emphasis will be placed on employment, wages, and consumer prices than on growth. I'm joined by VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide for more on this. Bill, what have authorities indicated so far about their new strategy for the next 5 years?
Well, this afternoon we had a press conference that lasted about an hour long and went over some of the key areas where they're going to be focusing on for development. And like you mentioned, jobs and wages and consumer prices are going to have more of an emphasis. They're going to continue to have a growth target of what the Xinhua says is 6.5%, that it's not going to go, growth here is not going to go below that during the five-year period, which is something that analysts would dispute. But in any case, there's a wide range of things that they're going to be looking at. Innovation is one thing that we've been hearing a lot about, and it was mentioned today at the press conference. And officials see that as a way of trying to move China up the manufacturing value chain. You know, China has long been the world's factory, and that's no longer the case as wages Of course, a lot of things are still made here, but wages are rising and factories and labor is shifting to other countries in the region like Southeast Asia. And so China is looking for ways to expand its growth. And it's also looking to focus on domestic consumption as well and rely less on exports.
You know, China's economy has had a bit of a downturn recently.
It sure has. And no one really knows for sure just how serious the situation is. There has long been concerns about figures that China releases, and there are some analysts and economists who say that the growth has already slowed beyond or further than the 6.5% that is supposed to be the goal for the next 5 years from 2016 to 2020. So we really don't know. There have been some bright spots, and that is that services sector continues to be performing quite well. The movie industry is doing quite well. It's having a banner year. And there are areas where that things seem to be going along. But exports, of course, and factories, the situation with that and with jobs and those who rely on those industries, the migrant workers, we are hearing more and more reports about job layoffs. And so that's a big concern.
It's interesting the use of this terminology, five-year plan, because that sort of it kind of harkens back to the time of Mao Zedong. Why are officials continuing to use this?
I think we, you know, as we look at China and its big modern cities of Beijing and Shanghai, and Guangzhou, Shenzhen, we can't forget that this is still a country that is largely run from the top down, okay? And for all that the government says about opening up its markets, it still wants to have play a key role in everything. So it's very much a planned economy, not so much as it was before, of course, in the past, but the government plays a large role in all kinds of areas. You know, I had an interesting conversation with someone in the music industry the other day, and he was talking with me about how, you know, if you want to get an artist to become popular, you still have to go through the government channels. You have to go through state media to get someone to become a popular artist. And so with music, with all kinds of areas of enterprises, the government is key. And even this innovation that the government is talking about, they're going to play a key role in promoting that and encouraging that. And they want to be the ones that are directing it and guiding it. And so some analysts feel that this is a contradiction. If you want to have innovation, you need to let the market play a bigger role. You need to open things up more. But at the same time, we see in many ways China is clamping down or it's tightening its grip on things. Even at the same time that it is saying that it's going to let market forces have freer rein.
Thanks very much, Bill. That's VOA correspondent Bill Ide reporting from Beijing. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
If you want to wake up and stay in a good mood all day long, a new study from researchers at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine suggests that you need to get a good night's sleep. Now, that's not necessarily a lot of sleep, but some good quality uninterrupted sleep. The researchers found that being roused from sleep several times a night puts a damper on a good mood more than having a small amount of sleep without any interruptions. Patrick Finnan, the study's lead author and an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins, says that when your sleep is disrupted throughout the night, you don't have the chance to go through each of the needed various phases of sleep. Not progressing through the stages of sleep can deprive you of the needed slow-wave sleep that is necessary, making a person feel refreshed and restored. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new pop tour. The 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution guarantees citizenship to anyone born on U.S. soil. That fact has led to a practice commonly known as birth tourism, in which pregnant women from many countries come to the U.S. to give birth so their children will be American citizens. Yang Chen has more from Washington.
In early October, a Taiwanese woman gave birth on a flight from Taiwan to Los Angeles. Since the plane was already in U.S. airspace at the time, the baby was granted U.S. citizenship, but the mother was deported to Taiwan. and has been criticized for allegedly lying about her pregnancy to have her child on U.S. soil. She's not the only woman suspected of lying about her pregnancy to get into the U.S. In March, federal agents raided about 20 Southern California locations believed to be involved in maternity tourism schemes, offering travel and lodging services to foreign pregnant women seeking to give birth in the United States. The so-called maternity hotels catered largely to women from China who paid $15,000 to $50,000 U.S. dollars each. While investigators in the case are looking into possible criminal offenses, it appears that any children born to the women involved would in fact be U.S. citizens.
Birthright citizenship applies to everyone who is born in the United States and subject to the laws of the United States. That is, everyone who is required to follow the laws of the United States.
Attorney James Ho says there are some exceptions, such as children of foreign diplomats. But he says children born to foreign tourists are covered.
They would be a U.S.-born child to a foreign tourist if they're born in the United States. My interpretation of law is that, yes, they would be U.S. citizens.
But law professor John Eastman believes the law is being misinterpreted. The key phrase, he says, is the term subject to U.S. jurisdiction.
If you were here illegally, to bring it to the modern context, you don't have this right to automatic citizenship guaranteed by the 14th Amendment.
As temporary visitors, he says, foreign women coming to the U.S. to give birth owe no allegiance to the U.S., nor do their children.
They owe allegiance and continue to owe allegiance to the nation of their parents' allegiance. And it's only because of this misunderstanding of the birthright citizenship that we've created that tourism industry in the first place.
Some Republican presidential hopefuls, including businessman Donald Trump and Texas Senator Ted Cruz, say they want to do away with the so-called birthright citizenship. To do that, though, would take a constitutional amendment, a lengthy and complicated process which is unlikely to happen anytime soon. Yang Chen for VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Two big pop stars are teaming up for a road trip to perform in front of their fans, but the tour comes at the expense of another big performer. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald stopped by our studio to explain to International Edition's Jim Stevenson what happened.
So kind of talk about Demi Lovato and her old pal Nick Jonas going out on tour together next year.
Two big stars hitting the road, and this is going to sure to please the fans.
Right. But there is an extra added element to this story, Jim, because this is a story of deception and betrayal. Earlier this month, Demi Lovato, the pop star, locked in Adam Lambert, fellow pop star, to open for her world tour next year. However, TMZ reports that Demi's manager, who also manages Nick Jonas, wanted her to replace Adam with Nick. Nick Jonas is hot. He's rising right now. He's had a few hits, but he doesn't have a tour. So Adam got dumped earlier in October. And unsurprisingly, he's not very happy about it. Angry words were exchanged between their two camps. But ultimately, things are going to turn out okay for Adam.
Tell me if I did, what's my price? I just wanna play
On Monday, Demi and Nick sang together at a private concert in New York. These two have a history. Demi and the Jonas Brothers, Nick's old group, starred together in the Camp Rock movies for Disney. They've practically grown up together. In fact, this will be the sixth tour Demi and Nick Jonas have made together. In addition, Demi used to date Nick's brother, Joe Jonas. So he's practically family. So as you can understand, these two are very happy to be back on tour together. And both of them are riding very cresting careers right now. Mm-hmm. Demi's fifth album, Confident, just opened at number 2 on the Billboard 200 pop album chart. Nick's self-titled second solo album went top 10. He's spun off 2 big hit singles. And so they'll be hitting the road together beginning June 24th, 2016. In Sunrise, Florida. As for Adam Lambert, he's going to be okay. He's doing a few radio station Christmas concerts here in the States. And in January, he'll tour Japan and Australia. And, of course, Adam Lambert is also the singer in Queen these days.
That's
so
right.
When Adam's not touring as a solo act, he's touring with Queen. So in the end, it's going to be okay for everybody.
Well, at least Adam Lambert has some working fans of his own to enjoy, and who knows? I mean, maybe he and Demi will get back together at some point.
You know, pop music makes strange bedfellows in every sense of the term.
It does indeed, but we're certainly glad to have you with us each and every week. Ray McDonald, he's the host of the Top 20 Countdown. Be sure to catch him. And also on Twitter, Ray, it is...
Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jim.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Everyone wins when girls go to school. For every year of education a girl attains, her future earning potential goes up by 10 to 20%. And because she is likely to share up to 90% of her earnings with her family and her community, everyone around her will benefit. Her children will be more than twice as likely to survive past the age of 5, and they will be healthier and more likely to go to school than will the children of her less literate sisters. Ultimately, educated girls grow into productive women who contribute to their country's economies and help pull others out of poverty. Nonetheless, over 62 million girls around the world are not in school, and millions more are fighting to stay there. Thus, to increase education opportunities for girls, the United States government introduced Let Girls Learn, a program through which a number of U.S. government agencies and non-governmental organizations, including the Department of State, U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the Peace Corps and the Millennium Challenge Corporation work together to address some of the obstacles preventing adolescent girls from attending and completing school and receiving high-quality education. Pakistan is one country where girls often find it difficult to attend school. This may be due to lack of funds, because they live too far from the nearest school, or because some within their society disapprove of education for girls, especially once they reach adolescence. That is why the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, and First Daughter of Pakistan, Mariam Sharif, launched the Let Girls Learn initiative in Pakistan on October 22, 2015, at the White House. This initiative will provide $70 million for new and existing education programs that will help educate 200,000 Pakistani girls between the ages of 10 and 19. Educated girls become women who strengthen their families, communities, and countries, said USAID Acting Administrator Alfonso Lenhart. By increasing access to educational opportunities during the critical time of adolescence, this important initiative will be transformative for Pakistan, empowering young women to overcome barriers and lift themselves out of poverty. We look forward to continuing to work with the government of Pakistan and our partners around the world to ensure girls everywhere get the education they deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.